Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. And listener, let me ask you how satisfied you are with your bank. Is their collection of weaponry up to scratch? If you cast a glance over their art collection, would you consider their depictions of old ladies being sexually assaulted by prime ministers to be satisfactory? Do the staff routinely encourage you to fondle bullion priced at about £333,000? Here's the clincher. Does your bank have the most cumbersome nickname in the history of nicknames? Might be time to change accounts. In the meantime, let's head to Threadneedle Street and the Bank of England.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sound. You ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Listener, I am under a vaulted and domed roof, which is just where I like to be, and we are in the heart, I think, of the Bank of England, and with me, Anna Spender, the curator of the Museum of the Bank of England. Hi.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Likewise. We were getting ready for the interview and you mentioned that you've only been in post for a few months, so this is a bold move for both of us.
Absolutely, but as I said, everything's fascinating to me, so hopefully I can point out a few interesting things along the way.
Hopefully so. So what we're going to be doing today is journeying around the museum and finding out about the history of this institution and this great big grey stone blob that's in the middle of the city. Maybe we could start by mapping out something about the building itself. And I think this wasn't the first place that the Bank of England has been.
No, that's right. The Bank of England was actually founded way back in 1694 as a way of raising funds for the war against France.
We'd run out of boats, hadn't we?
We had. And a genius idea came about where members of the public could subscribe to a loan, effectively, that was given to the government. And they managed to raise £1,200,000 in 11 days, I believe. And lots of different subscribers, including King William himself, who handed over £10,000. Lots of different people, right down to chemists and bakers who donated £20. So it was established for the good of the public, and that's still our central function today.
You putting it like that makes me realise there's no difference between war bonds and crowdfunding, is there?
No, it seems very similar. At that time, the bank building itself was actually in Cheapside in the Mercers Hall. It moved the following year to Prince's Street, just next to the bank. So for 40 years it was in rented accommodation, and it wasn't until 1734 that the bank moved to its present site on Threadneedle Street. And it was actually the estate of John Houblon, who was the first governor of the Bank of England. So effectively it was his house that the bank moved into. Over the centuries it's increased in size with demand, and the bank obviously got busier and busier over time. The exterior of the bank that we see today is down to an architect by the name of John Soane. He was architect and surveyor of the bank from 1788 through to 1833. However,
This is a big however.
The bank during the First World War needed to expand dramatically. So along came Herbert Baker, a very famous architect, 1925, started to demolish Soane's work and effectively did that in segments so that the bank could carry on functioning. So a lot of what we see today dates to 1925 through to about 1939, which may surprise a lot of people.
Are we conveniently close to something that we could point at and identify it as one of those two styles?
Well, we can. We're actually in the what we call the stock office as you come into the museum. And this big domed ceiling is actually Herbert Baker's reconstruction of Soane's stock office. So you get a taste of what the original bank here would have been like. But Herbert Baker expanded the building both up and down. It goes down three levels and up seven. So in old photographs of the bank, you'll just see sort of a very low building sort of hiding away in the city. Now it sort of rises much higher.
Well, that surprises me. On the way past, I never get the impression that it's as tall as that.
Absolutely.
Is that clever architectural design?
I would think so. And I think going down obviously helps and sort of making room for the gold vaults below, which a lot of people are very interested in, and they can learn a lot more here at the museum, including being able to hold one of our very own gold bars.
Well, that sounds like, yes, the highlight of any tour, and you can take it home for your very own.
I wouldn't say that. You can buy a copy in the gift shop.
Can you really?
Yeah.
That's a bit tacky.
Well, you know.
Yeah, we've got to do what we've got to do. We'll come back to gold, by the way, I hope, because there's a lot to say about the gold standard and all of that stuff. I'm genuinely confused by it, because there seem to be all sorts of variants on what the gold standard stands for. But where are we going to begin our look around?
If we begin our walk around the museum in the stock office, you're presented by a model of a boat. Now, this I find very useful.
I need to paint a picture here, because when you say a model of the boat, what I'm seeing is more sort of a ribbed outbuilding. On closer inspection, yes, it does look like the ribs of a boat with a bit of decking there, but it's a cross-section from maybe the middle of a boat.
Absolutely. So visitors are able to board the boat, which is a metaphor for the bank. It will explain some difficult themes, what different aspects of the bank does. So we have information about the Financial Policy Committee, Monetary Policy Committee, the inflation rate, quantitative easing, all of those complicated things. So the boat is being guided through sort of economical storms and all of that sort of thing. So it really does explain what we do today. Lots of different interactives and films that visitors can watch as well to really understand what we do.
I ask this with an angle to my question. What's your background before you came here?
My background, nothing to do with money or the economy. I actually worked for 15 years at Hever Castle in Kent. So I come from a Tudor background, if you like, but I'm a historian at heart.
So, well, okay, my suspicion has been satisfied then, because this is obviously a huge change from what you've been working on, and the Tudors kind of naturally lend themselves to a public and international interest, don't they, with blood and sex and all that stuff. How do you go about tackling some of these, well, let's face it, kind of dry ideas?
Well, I think the museum is a really good way of doing that, because, well, for me, for example, it is a very complicated issue. But I think to make something interactive and fun is a good way to learn. And it's something that affects everybody. It just doesn't affect one part of society. It's everybody. So a museum is a lovely place to come and get your head around all of those complicated issues.
How did you take on that learning curve?
I visited the museum several times before I started here, but I do spend time in here most days. And whereas we always think about the bank as money and economy, the museum explains much more than that. It's not, the bank isn't just about money. It's about lots of different things. It produces banknotes. We have gold here. Lots of interesting people have worked here. For example, Kenneth Graham, who wrote Wind in the Willows. He worked here for 30 years. So it's much more. So hopefully visitors to the museum will get a nice sort of rounded view of the bank's history and what we do today.
Looking at some of the concepts that are suggested on the, I want to call them sales, but they're not. They're part of the material of the ship. Inflation targets, banknotes, the safeguarding of the financial system, financial policy committees. Could you pick out a jewel amongst these?
I would probably say inflation. It's a good topic at the moment. We've got very low inflation. I think at present it's 0.1%. Inflation target is 2%. So again, something that many people might find a little bit difficult to understand, but it is something that people encounter day to day. And as I mentioned before, we have interactives that people sort of hands-on can get to grips with the idea.
Is there a disconnect, do you think? I mean, I don't know if you find this in your own personal life when you go to a shop to buy something. Do you readily connect the price of the object in front of you or the process of purchasing it or how much money you've got in your pocket in the first place? Do you readily connect it with these concepts?
Not necessarily, funnily enough. I'm probably starting to think about it a little bit more now I've been here a few months. You know, I think this really brings it home to everybody that it is the bread that you buy, you know, the milk that you put on your cereal, not just big things like houses and cars and that sort of thing. It's the everyday things that it's really important.
Could you give us a nugget that we might not know about inflation?
Oh, gosh.
maybe that's
now. I'm not an economist.
I'll let you wind your way up to that one or sidestep it gracefully. Just as a bit of a tangent, we had, because I think we're going to be heading towards some currency examples at some point here, and we had some guys on the show a few weeks ago who have set up their own currency in Brixton, and I know there are other initiatives like that around the country in Bristol and so forth. And reading up on some of the history here, I was looking at which institutions are and are not allowed to issue currency. Could you give us an overview of that side of things?
Yes, well, the Bank of England has issued banknotes in this country since it was founded in 1694.
So now, at that point, these were sort of promissory notes based on the investment that individuals had made?
They were effectively IOUs for depositing your gold with the goldsmiths. Handwritten notes.
Sorry, that's it. You were handing gold in?
Yes, so it's effectively a receipt, I suppose, if you like to think of it that way, which you'd hand back to get your gold back.
So the country's in crisis, presumably under threat. I think the French were involved. Why was it only gold that they were interested in particular, not other precious metals or precious stuff?
Yeah, so gold, I believe, was used for coinage and that sort of thing, and it was what you used to purchase items. We'll see shortly how the bank got its famous nickname, the Old Lady of Threadneedle Street, and that was during the restriction period, which at that time we were also under threat of invasion from France again, and the Prime Minister at the time, William Pitt, wanted to restrict the public using gold to pay for things so that he had enough gold to pay for the war. And it was at that time that the bank started issuing small denominations of banknotes, £1 notes, £2 notes, for the public to use. It was very unpopular. A lot of the public were used to paying with gold coins. Many of them couldn't read either, so they couldn't understand what the banknotes meant. And at this time, counterfeiting was rife. It was very easy to copy a banknote. And at that time, this is at the end of the 18th century, I believe there were over 300 people that were executed for counterfeiting, so it was a serious crime at that time.
But presumably the risk of counterfeiting was less of a pressing danger than the risk of clipping?
Yes. Now, the risk of clipping, I do know a little bit about that, but you are probably best to talk to the Royal Mint about that, who deal with all of our coinage. So we're more banknotes at the Bank of England.
And a banknote at that time looked like what?
Yes, let's go and see. So if we go through to the early years section of the museum, we'll be able to see a very important document belonging to the bank. The museum is organised in a sort of chronological order. So when you pass the section about what the bank does today, we have a small section about when the bank was founded in 1694. And here you will see the Royal Charter that was issued by William III announcing the founding of the Bank of England.
Which is a poster-sized piece, very ornately decorated around the edges with a picture, I suspect, of His Majesty in the top left. Very, very tiny writing. And essentially boiling down to what?
Well, this is the official Royal Charter that supports the bank as the government's banker, effectively, and debt tech manager, and that's exactly what we do today. Its function hasn't changed.
There's some fine distinctions. Normally I would think about leaving this till later in the chronology of the development of the bank, but it might be worth separating these ideas now, because I think at this point it wasn't a central bank or it wasn't a national bank. There's some fine distinctions of terminology.
I suppose at that time it was a central bank. It's actually, the Bank of England is actually the second oldest central bank in the world. I think the oldest central bank is the Swedish central bank. So effectively it was the central bank of England. Next to the charter, you'll also see the subscription book that contains all of the names of the private investors to the original Bank of England, together with the amount of money that they subscribed. And there are 1,268 subscriptions. It was a very popular idea. I believe that people were promised an 8% return on their money for perpetuity. So it seemed like a good deal at the time. And as I say, the king himself even subscribed money towards this, a total of just over £1 million at that time. There are ordinary people in the subscription book as well. There are bakers, chemists, those sort of people as well. So it sort of covered all areas of society.
I noticed Britannia over there. I'm not sure if there's anything to say. I just noticed her figure starts appearing this early.
Yes.
In relation to our currency?
Absolutely. And Britannia is a wonderful symbol for the Bank of England. She's been on our banknotes since the beginning in 1694 and has been ever since. So she's a symbol of stability and strength and resilience, I suppose. She's always been there.
I was delighted to discover, just because it's one of those little historical curiosities, that the monarch has by no means been on the banknotes for all that time.
Absolutely. The Queen has only been on our banknotes since 1960, so relatively recently, I suppose, and historical figures first appeared on banknotes in 1970. And even at that time, some of the older banknotes were still in circulation, the big white ornate banknotes were still in circulation. So it's only relatively recently that we're seeing the currency that we're used to today.
Shall we drift along and have a look at some of those early items of currency?
The Sound of London. Londonist Out Loud with N. Quentin Wolfe. Listen free every week on your favourite podcast platform. Subscribe via iTunes and get great extra content at londonist.com. Tweet the show at Londonist Sound and see pictures of all our guests on the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram. Londonist.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Out Loud is free every week. You can support the show and Londonist via the Londonist shop, where you'll find excellent gift ideas, including London postcode t-shirts, The Secrets of the Tube DVD, chunky logo mugs, tote bags, hoodies, the Inspector Sands tea, and the Londonist Oyster card holder. Treat yourself, support us, and share your love of London at londonist.com/shop.
We're moving through a wood-panelled rabbit warren of low-lit rooms. Lighting must be an issue with all that, because this is very much document territory. You must be careful about how you illuminate the artefacts.
Absolutely. We've got a mixture of original documents and facsimiles here, purely because we do have to be very careful about the environment in here. So you will find some areas of the museum are very dimly lit.
Right beside of the doorway here, I've got two things that I could look at. One of them is a cartoon and the other is a £1 million note. I'm going to resist looking down. I'm going to look at the cartoon.
Wonderful. So, the cartoon that you're seeing here dates to 1797, and this is by the famous cartoonist James Gilray. And this is a very important cartoon in that this is where we first see the nickname of the Bank of England, the Old Lady of Threadneedle Street. And you can see an old lady dressed in the new £1 notes being ravished by William Pitt, the Prime Minister. She's protecting the Bank of England's gold. He was trying to get to the gold to pay for the wars with France, but the old lady here is protecting her store of gold.
And the speech bubble here, she's a crone covered in banknotes, and she's saying, "Murder, murder, rape, murder, oh you villain, what have I kept my honour untainted so long to have it broke up by you at last? Oh, murder, rape, ravishment, ruin, ruin, ruin." 4 exclamation marks. Was this reflective of the popular mood in relation to this move? Seems as though there was a bit of popular excitement about it.
There was, as I mentioned before, that the public weren't happy that they were being issued with these £1 notes rather than being able to use their gold coins. So it is a reflection of the time and the political situation at the end of the 18th century.
Shall we move through?
This
has a Hellenic feel straight away. Busts are plenty, Corinthian columns. And firearms. I hope this bit of the interview goes well. I could be in trouble. Muskets, rifles, bayonets fixed. And there's a very particular feeling in this part of the building. This seems... you can feel that it's structurally different. Why is that? Do we know?
I don't know, I'm afraid. We are actually working on a project to refurbish this area of the museum next year, so that will be something nice for our visitors to come and see towards the end of next year. But the Banknote Gallery is a really interesting space. It explains the history of our banknotes from the very beginnings to present day. So in the far corner, you'll see some of our early banknotes, and as you can see, they look rather different to the way they do today. They're much larger, they're on white paper, and many of them were handwritten. But there are some similar themes, if you like. You'll be able to see the image of Britannia on all of them. You'll see that on our banknotes today. And also the wording "promise to pay," which has been on our banknotes since the very beginning and is still on our banknotes today.
And they look like checks, don't they?
They do. And as we mentioned before, they were IOUs, effectively. An interesting fact is that the cashier at the time would actually have to sign every single banknote, whereas the signature is printed on the banknotes these days, but they had to physically sign every single banknote, and that was their job all day, every day, signing their name.
What was the practical usage then of these as currency in the early days? How usable were they?
They were extremely usable. Originally being a receipt, if you like, people actually found it much easier to deal with paper money than with gold. So it just became much more popular with the population, and the idea stuck. So it's something that we've kept to this day.
I wonder if this had an effect on crime right away, because it must be easier to dispose of gold rather than signed pieces of paper that you can track.
I suppose in terms of crime, the biggest threat was counterfeiting. And we do have a display case in here about forgeries, some of the tools that were used. Some of them were very sophisticated.
And this looks very much like a surgeon's apparatus.
It does indeed. A lot of these tools were used to create copper plates so that the counterfeiters were able to print their own banknotes.
We can see one here, okay, in the background. And of course it's reversed because it's for printing on, and we can see the denomination name of the name, a calligraphed word, one at the top, Bank of England, one, and the rest of it's in a sort of a copper plate hat. Ah, copper plate, mm. On a copper plate.
Copper plate, mm, absolutely. And I believe that is how we produce our banknotes today as well, very similar sort of method. But as you follow the gallery through, you'll see the development of the banknotes.
We've got something that looks much more recognisably like currency straight away. Instead of the very thin writing and the thin lines to write upon to keep your handwriting straight, here we've got an ornate pattern that fans out from a central image. Everything's very detailed. You can see that some serious effort has been put into making this difficult to copy.
Absolutely. And that's the key thing. When we start seeing these ornate patterns, this was a really key move to try and prevent counterfeiting, to make a design so complicated that no one could possibly replicate it. And just behind us we have our geometric chuck lathe. This dates to the early 20th century. But this is the sort of machinery that was used in the design of banknotes. And just to put it in very, very simple terms, it's a little bit like a spirograph.
For listeners who do not have a geometric chuck lathe at home, this is a garden bench size base, and on top of it an enormous, like the innards of a grandfather clock, but a really big one. From that, I'm guessing he's produced the near holographic quality that you get on a banknote.
Absolutely. And you can see on the top of the machine there the sort of workings of a banknote design there. But yeah, producing these very, very complicated images, much more complicated these days, much more sophisticated. But yes, as we move down, we'll start to recognise some of the banknotes that have been used fairly recently. We have the Shakespeare £20 note.
As we move towards Shakespeare, I notice that the notes are getting smaller.
They are indeed.
I know early in the life of paper currency, the back side of it was left blank. We're moving up towards some stuff here that has many more of the signature features of a note in your wallet today. There's that a blank spot in the middle which might contain some sort of watermark. There's a figurehead, in this case, once again, Britannia, but a notice, a recognisable facial representation.
Absolutely. As I say, she's been on the banknotes since the very beginning of time.
I didn't realise she had such a prominent position, though. She looks like she's taken the place of the monarch here, really.
Well, this is just before the time when Queen Elizabeth was on the banknotes. This is the late 1950s. So, yes, this is where the monarch's face would be. And you'll also see images of lions on a lot of our banknotes. Again, very symbolic image of strength and security and sort of the protectors of a financial institution, if you like.
Well, and it makes a lot of sense suddenly, because what you were saying at the beginning there, people need to have confidence in the currency, don't they? They need to believe that this piece of paper is going to be cashed in for, certainly early on, an amount of gold.
Absolutely.
So you want to be filling their head with ideas of security.
That's exactly right, and that is one of the bank's main functions. We need to instill that sense of trust in the public that their banknote is going to be worth what it says on it. So, yeah, it's a very important idea. As we move through, we'll start to recognise some more familiar banknotes, looking much more like the sort of thing we're used to today, showing the monarch's profile. We have here the Shakespeare £20 note that was issued in 1970. This is the first banknote to show an historic figure. And it's incidentally the first time that a £20 note had been issued since just after the Second World War.
Why is that?
It was to do with the war, and we needed to restrict the sort of larger notes. And it wasn't until 1970 that they decided to try and reintroduce the larger denominations. So up until the 1940s, the £20 note looked like one of the big, white, old-fashioned banknotes, so it was quite a step away from what it used to be like.
Have you got any of those in period pieces? You often see people unfolding a note from their pocket and it looks like a newspaper. Have you got one of those in real life?
Well, we've probably it's probably one of these sorts of banknotes.
Yeah, this is the sort of thing. Yeah. More or less A5.
Yeah, sort of A5 in size, very thin paper, black and white, very ornate handwriting that, of course, was printed later on. So, yes, sort of three times as large as the sort of banknote that we're used to.
And I'm imagining that you must experience a lot of people come into this final cabinet with the notes from the 70s and 80s and making approving clucks of recognition.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We do have a lot of families and schools that come to visit us here, but many of the visitors do remember these sorts of banknotes, and it is a nostalgic thing. It's nice for them to come and see these banknotes again, you know, now that they're not in circulation.
There's something uniquely pleasing about Florence Nightingale. Just the colours, actually. I don't see that combination of colours elsewhere. There's a sort of almost black shade of brown behind Florence Nightingale. This is on the 10. And then a pinky, orangey colour in the background blending into yellow. All sorts of memories cropping up straight away from childhood, I guess. Do you know what I wanted to ask you? It was about the different denominations of note and how much that's changed over time.
It hasn't really changed hugely over time. We've always had a 5, 10, 20, 50. We no longer see the £1 notes. There were £2 notes at some time, and odd denominations as well. You mentioned the £1 million note earlier as well. So,
is that just a publicity thing, or is that really useful for something?
I think that probably was more of a publicity thing, but it may have been a receipt for that amount of gold that was deposited. So, yeah, denominations haven't changed hugely over time. The appearance of banknotes have, and our modern-day banknotes, of course, are much brighter in colour. And we're starting to work with the public now, deciding on the next banknote characters. So it's very much an all-inclusive thing, rather than just something that the bank does itself.
How are you going about that?
At the moment, we have a nomination period that we are looking for the character for the next £20 note, which will be issued at the moment, sort of due 2018. And the theme is visual artists. So this includes painters, architects, sculptors, photographers, filmmakers, and that sort of thing. And I think it will be announced at some time next year, I believe.
Well, there's no easy segue, I suspect, but you're standing in front of a cabinet full of guns.
We are indeed.
In fact, we're in a room that there are guns everywhere you look, and spears and swords, not what one would expect to find in a monetary museum.
No.
Are we expecting trouble?
We're no longer expecting trouble. These sorts of things originate from the 1790s, 1780s, 1790s. The bank was actually attacked during the Gordon riots. At that time, the bank was actually next to a church called St. Christopher Le Stocks, and the mob had actually climbed to the top of the church and started throwing things into the bank. And it was at this time that the bank's picket was established. So this is a small army, if you like, of uniformed men that would patrol daily to make sure that there wasn't anything untoward. And this carried on through right until the 1970s. So, as I say, we no longer need any of these things, but it's an important part of the bank's history.
I'm surprised that it kept going as late as that. By that point, was it a token defence?
It was. It was more of a tradition. And we still do have traditions here at the bank. At the bank's main entrance on Threadneedle Street, you may see one of our gatekeepers in his pink tailcoats and top hat. And again, that's from a bygone age. We call those the Hublon Pinks. And that was the colour combination that was used for John Hublon's house staff. As I mentioned, the bank was originally John Hublon's house in the 1730s, so it's a hark back to those earlier times, but a lovely thing to see and nice to keep those traditions.
Although in the day, presumably, that was not the job that you wanted because it came with the pink uniform.
Well, I believe that there was great honour in wearing the pink uniform, and and even today, it's a highly respected thing. It's a very important thing to do. Would you like to see the gold?
A phrase that I don't hear often enough. Yes. Show me the money.
Okay, so here we have...
Oh, show me the gold. You've shown me the money. Show me the gold.
Show you the gold. So here we are at our Gold Bar. This is a London Good delivery bar that visitors to the museum are able to try and lift.
Can we just have that phrase again? A London Good delivery bar?
Yes, that's the technical term for a Gold Bar.
What does it mean?
I don't know.
I mean, does that suggest that it's a brand and there are different sorts of Gold Bar, or is it about the design?
I don't know. There is a very specific design, a very specific shape. You know, they're all marked, so we know where they've come from. We do hold about 400,000 bars of gold here at the bank in our vaults, right underneath the museum. The Gold Bar weighs about 13 kilograms, and so it is very, very heavy. And interestingly enough, the Bank of England only owns two Gold Bars, and they're both in the museum. So one the visitors can attempt to lift, and the other is in our gold corridor display. So yes, it may surprise some people.
Well, it does surprise me. There's a picture right here, a black and white picture, probably from the first half of the 20th century, with a fellow noting down how many gold bars he's got in some sort of secure cellar. He appears to have a lot of gold, and the bank only has two bars of gold. What's the reason for this disparity?
So the Bank of England effectively holds the gold for other governments, other central banks around the world, and the Treasury. So it's almost like a holding bay, if you like, a safe store. As I mentioned, there are over 400,000 bars of gold down there. They have to be stored in a very certain way as well because of the sheer weight of them. The bank is built on London clay, so it's quite a soft platform, if you like, and the gold has to be stored around the edge of the vault to prevent it from sinking.
Well, and gold itself is quite soft, isn't it?
It is very soft and very easy to mark. Somewhere like the Gold Reserve in New York are able to pile their gold as high as they like. They're on bedrock, so they haven't got to worry, but there's a very specific way. And there are lots of images and information here in the museum to show our visitors how that works, including a huge image in our gold corridor of the gold vaults. And we do encourage our visitors to take their very own gold vault selfie, hashtag gold vault selfie, and they can post this on the museum's Twitter feed, which is hashtag BOE Museum, so visitors can feel like they've visited the gold vaults here.
Do members of the general public ever get to take a squint at the gold under us?
They don't, I'm afraid, no, and many members of staff don't get to visit either, so yeah, it's very much just a holding bay for the gold.
So we're looking here at the bar in question, and it's in very, very thick reinforced glass. There's a hole through in the manner of one of those boxes that scientists do particularly dangerous experiments in. You can reach through the hole and touch the gold. And in your first 3 months in this job, what are the standard reactions for people inserting their limbs?
It's a bit of a challenge, really. I think a lot of people don't realise how heavy a bar of gold actually is. It's much denser than lead. In addition to that, just above the case with the gold bar, it does tell you how much that gold bar is worth today. And as we can see today, it's worth just over £300,000. So I think it's that idea of lifting something that is that valuable, and it's wonderful to see the expressions on visitors' faces.
Do you mind if I have a go?
Of course.
We're reaching in. Now it says it's 13 kilos. I should be able to manage this. It says Switzerland on the top. Yes, I can confirm that is a meaty, dense piece of material. We're coming close to the end. Well, we're coming close to the end of our time, but you're coming close to throwing the doors open to the public. And I know that there's always an enormous queue outside the bank. Is that for the museum or to look around other places here as well?
The museum is the only part of the bank that's open to the public. It's open Monday to Friday, 10 till 5. We do open for special events on occasional weekends throughout the year. And we do have school holiday events as well that take place throughout the year. And these can all be found on the museum's website on our What's On page.
Well, thanks for showing us around today. I suppose my final question, Anna Spender, did you just get the job because of your name?
It's funny you should say that. My mother actually works in a bank as well. So, she's had exactly the same comments from her customers. No, it's just a funny coincidence, I think.
But not one you want to ever hear any more about.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anna Spender, thanks very much.
You're welcome. My heart
aches for some fire. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Anna Spender. Thanks to Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.